in his hollow men, politically reactionary, but innovative and evocative and sometimes insightful and verbally striking poet T.S. Eliot thought about two possibilities. In 1925, when the poem was written, or rather assembled, the world hadn't ended with the bang of World War I. But according to Eliot, it was whimpering to a close with cultural decline. And the question of how the world will end will be a theme in this talk. If you've come here in the expectation that you will find really useful tips for making your fortune on the stock exchange, then I offer you my profound apologies. The bang option actually is open today with nuclear weapons and US-Chinese confrontation. The world ending with a bang is a real possibility to which the Australian government is enthusiastically contributing with its latest agreement to have nuclear-powered submarines in association with the United States and Britain. Then there's the wheeze possibility for how the world will end, with COVID and the plagues which are likely to follow it. And there's also the sizzle future with global warming and massive wildfires. And short of the world ending, there are multiple crises There are multiple crises that are going on and affecting the lives of vast numbers of people. Authoritarian and fascist regimes, the oppression of women and racism are making life miserable for huge numbers of human beings. Amidst all this doom and gloom, it's easy to miss, even by most radical commentators, the impersonal evil that underpins all of these terrible outcomes. We can attribute all of these issues to the relations of production which constitute the economic structure of society, the real foundation on which arises a legal and political superstructure and to which correspond definite forms of social consciousness, as Marx put it in the preface to his contribution to A Critique of Political Economy. Under capitalism, those relations of production revolve around the competitive pursuit of profit. That pursuit of profit is changing the planet's ecology and human interactions with each other and other species to increase the likelihood of pandemics like COVID-19. The pursuit of profit is emptying carbon sinks in the form of ancient fossil fuels. More recent depositions like those in the permafrosts towards the poles and the living plants that are still being slashed and burnt for agriculture and pastoralism, all of which results in the planet heating up. Through competition among capitals over raw materials, markets and extra economic leverage, which takes the form of competition among capitalist states, production for profit is giving rise to wars. And those who benefit from this production for profit have an interest in sustaining competition amongst workers by reinforcing sexism, nationalism, and racism, which undermine wages and boost profits by dividing the working class within countries and across the planet. Sexism enables the cheaper reproduction of labour power. Racism, like nationalism, creates a false identity between the exploited and exploiters that enhances the authority of ruling classes. Victim blaming of all kinds distracts attention from the real causes of the problems that we face. But competition in making profits is not the end of the story of the relations of production and the overall logic of capitalism, the logic that lies at the very heart of the system, that is, the process of competitive capital accumulation. The pursuit of profit is only part of the logic of capitalist relations of production. Competition amongst individual capitalists and amongst capitalists backed by particular states is crucial. It means that capitalists are compelled to invest in order to continue to make profits, in order to invest, in order to make profits, in order to invest, and so ad infinitum. Capitalists pursue profits by trying to gain an advantage over or catch up with rivals by investing in more and better technologies embodied in machinery, equipment, and buildings. And that is the secret of the phenomenal increases in the productivity of human labour over the history of capitalism, something that Marx drew attention to in the Communist Manifesto. So the system that gives rise to the problems I've already talked about is not just one that's based on profit making. It's not just a system based on greed. It's not just uncontrolled capitalism. While it has been ruled out by the actual course of historical development, it is possible to conceive of a capitalism without ecological, including health disasters, without sexism, without racism, but a system of capital accumulation but a system without capital accumulation would in no sense be capitalism. And the process of capital accumulation necessarily gives rise to the system's tendency to break down strictly economically and to go through recurrent economic crises. Crises that impoverish millions of the exploited and thereby kill vast numbers who starve and or have inadequate hygiene or healthcare. This logic and the crises that it gives rise to predated the acceleration of global warming and the current plague, and that logic is still at work. As human labour becomes more productive, thanks to the application of more extensive and newer technologies and equipment, these allow innovative capitalists to boost their profits at the expense of their slow coach rivals. But when those rivals catch up or lose their customers to the innovators, the overall rate of profit falls. That is, the new value created by workers, and it is only workers who create new value, the new value created by workers declines as there is more and more investment in machinery, equipment, and buildings which embody superior more technologies that make human beings more productive. Eventually, that process leads capital accumulation to grind to a halt, that is, to economic crises. And such crises are only overcome by smashing working class living standards or the junking of significant amounts of machinery, equipment, and buildings. So there is a tendency for the world to end because capitalist production breaks down to its core relations of production. Its sound is not a military bang or a cultural whimper, but the metallic screech of machinery as it grinds to a halt, to the accompaniment of the hunger groans and moans in desperation of the unemployed. Okay, that's all essentially background. On to the world economy today and what may or may not be happening. COVID has had drastic economic impacts on the world economy. But capitalist production chugs on. What is happening in the world economy today? Well, who the fuck knows? Probably nobody really knows. we can have a pretty good idea of what's happened to the world economy in the past, even in the pretty recent past. More or less accurate accounts are retrospective of what's going on now, are retrospective because they don't rely on immediate short-term indicators like stock market indexes, which in any case have a very indirect connection with actual production, but rather on statistics that take time to collect. And on the basis of information we have about the past combined with what we know about the logic of the system, it's possible to make some sort of guesses about the medium to the long term. But as to the actual present and the short-term future, that's much more difficult. Importantly, the world economy was already slowing before COVID hit. Ooh, there we are. Here we have a graph of quarter-on-quarter economic growth in current US dollars since 2016. And you can see that the world that the, here we are. This is annual growth of the world economy since 2000. And you can see that gross domestic product plunged dramatically with the impact of COVID. We don't have the figures for 2021 yet, but there has been an upward trend that's already started. So what have governments' responses to the onset of COVID been? Responses that have played a significant part in this dramatic contraction, the most dramatic contraction in the global economy in history, I think. Well, governments have engaged in lockdowns. The hardness of lockdowns has varied a lot. In some places, notably Japan and Sweden, there were no lockdowns, and that's also true of a number of countries with limited levels of capital accumulation, that is, underdeveloped countries. In other countries like the USA and Brazil, there were no national lockdowns, but there were lockdowns in some federal states, but not in others. In India, there was a national lockdown, and after that ended, lockdowns in some states. In many countries, there have been rises in expenditure on healthcare and huge increases in state handouts, especially in the more developed countries. These handouts were designed particularly to sustain businesses and also, in some cases at least, to sustain idle and otherwise unpaid labour power, that is, workers. And these outlays have been funded by, and generally by, printing money, quantitative easing, which also kept interest rates low, thus cheapening borrowing and encouraging consumption and investment to keep the economy going. Clearly, governments in many countries were worried that COVID and then lockdowns would lead to serious shortages of labour power. It initially seemed that there could be very high death rates due to the disease that could affect the ability of capitalists to make profits by exploiting human labour. And lockdowns meant that vastly more unemployed workers would have problems sustaining themselves and their families. So to preserve labour power and especially to keep hold of workers with local specialist skills and to secure votes in bourgeois democracies with elections in sight, there were handouts to workers above the usual level of unemployed benefits. And there were also schemes like JobKeeper in Australia that subsidised bosses to keep workers on the payroll. And there were also moratoriums on debt and rent, both for individuals and for firms. In poorer countries, the responses have varied as they have in the richer countries. There have been lockdowns in some, but not others. There have been measures to prop up business, but they've generally been weaker than in the richer countries, and support for the unemployed has generally been minimal or non-existent. Countries have experienced V-shaped recessions. Output fell dramatically and then quickly and even more rapidly recovered in most countries. That was the case in Australia already before the onset of the Delta strain, and the New South Wales and federal governments decided on a prolonged weak lockdown to soften people up for their goal of forcing us to live with the virus, that is, to die from the virus. It's also been the case in China and the USA that there have been rapid V-shaped recoveries. And here you can see the two by far largest economies in the world and their pattern of economic growth quarter on quarter. So you can see that the rate of recovery was even greater than the rate of contraction, and then it slackened off a bit. The main reason for the V-shaped economic declines was that lockdowns, other restrictions, and reduced investment and consumption due to uncertainty halted much of production. As a commentator in the Sydney Morning Herald put it, with some mild exaggeration, increasingly the evidence points to the main cause of downturns being fear, with or without lockdowns. People tend to stay home if they think that venturing out has a reasonable chance of causing death. So even without lockdowns in Japan and Sweden, for example, that was the case. There were sharp contractions and then recovery. After lockdowns, there has been reopening and returns to more normal patterns of production, investment, and consumption. Once the lockdowns ended, production and consumption generally bounced back more rapidly than they had fallen. The pattern and timing of the downturn and then the recovery has been very uneven across countries, mainly depending on the timing and the extent of lockdowns domestically and in trade partners and contractions of consumption and investment by fearful and uncertain in individuals and businesses, and also affected by the timing of the initial onset of the plague in different countries. Countries particularly reliant on tourism and international trade have been harder hit as well. After lockdowns, it's been back to business as usual, or back to normality, but not to health normality in terms of the scale of illness and mounting COVID death toll. Rather, it's been a return to a kind of economic normality. But where further lockdowns have occurred, they have resulted in further sharp contractions. The level of integration with the world economy means that lockdowns in one country can affect supply chains, the movement of raw materials, other inputs, or finished products to other countries. And that has contributed to the unevenness of economic growth and the connections between economic growth in one country and other countries. But it's clear that the rapid initial recovery is not being sustained. As the London Financial Times put it, it was inevitable that the pace of the global recovery from the corona pandemic would slow. Reopening an economy may often happen in stages, but it can only happen once. The sudden surge of growth that follows a resumption of economic activity after a lockdown cannot be repeated, and the easing of less stringent restrictions will not lead to the same sort of boost. But recent softening in some key data is a concern. Not only does it reflect the spread of the more infectious Delta variant and supply chain worries, but also a slowdown in China. At present, growth is returning to the slow trajectory that was apparent before COVID, and GDP has, in some countries, after an initial boost, contracted again. The COVID crisis has led to a number of developments in much of the world economy. There has been a boom in fictitious capital, that is, in the price of pieces of paper that are claimed to shares in income from different financial investments, most notably share prices. And this has been due to an expansion of money supplies in many countries and a reluctance of those who have, especially the rich, who have benefited from the measures to boost the economies through expanding the money supply, a reluctance of those to invest in production. And instead, they've put much of their increased income into shares and other financial instruments, bidding their price up. There's also been a dramatic increase in inequality because this has largely been due to price rises in the assets owned by the wealthy and also handouts to businesses. There have been rising levels of private, corporate, and government debt too. And there's been some price inflation due to output restrictions by lockdowns and the expanded money supply. There's also been an increase in monopolisation and mergers and acquisitions as larger corporations have been best placed to survive the crisis and take advantage both of government handouts and the even greater weakness of working class organisations, as most social democratic parties have collaborated with governments or been in government and pursued policies indistinguishable from those of conservative parties. So the concentration and centralisation of capital has accelerated. The number of capitalist enterprises has declined and their average size has dramatically increased. Something that hasn't changed is inter-imperialist rivalry, particularly between the USA and China. Both have, for example, tried to use their vaccines to gain leverage, to gain advantages. Most recently, we have seen major increases in belligerent military postures and spending in the USA, supported by such social chauvinists as Bernie Sanders, and Australia, where the Labor Party has smiled back in the mirror of government policy. Government and ruling class worries about sustaining labor power and preserving their own lives have abated. The health risks from COVID-19, at least the Alpha and to some extent the now dominant Delta variants, are now clearer. Death rates have fallen due to improved treatments, especially for the rich, and the availability of vaccines, which have some degree of effectiveness. Now, governments and ruling classes are focused on restoring production and hence profits. After the first year of the plague, where zero COVID was sustained without widespread and prolonged lockdowns, and states have been willing to continue policies that continue that situation in some countries, it's proved that zero COVID has proved to be an effective and cheap strategy. That's been most significantly the case in China, but also in New Zealand and the smaller Australian states and territories. The Chinese regime may have been particularly concerned because of the much higher death rate from COVID there, and therefore the greater threat to the supply of labour power, as you can see from this chart. So initial levels of mortality from COVID have decreased reasonably significantly. Particularly, they've dropped dramatically in the United States, largely due to vaccination, also dropped in Australia. In China, the death rate has been somewhat less. But the death rate is of people who are known to have contracted the virus. So in China, the strategy to deal with the high death rate was to try and ensure that fewer people contracted the virus. Before COVID, China had accumulated, while much of the world economy stagnated, because of high profits due to low wages combined with state-directed reinvestment in strategic sectors. Its highly centralised and authoritarian state responded relatively quickly to constrain COVID after the initial cover-up in Wuhan. But in most of the rest of the world, including the United States, Britain, Germany, France, India, Indonesia, and Australia, governments decided that serious lockdowns and measures to support workers were too expensive. In some cases, like Australia, after going through phases of trying to achieve zero COVID, in other cases, zero COVID was pretty much rejected from the start. And there's been a shift back to notions of fiscal responsibility, to justifying cutting back public expenditure that particularly benefits workers. A huge expansion of public expenditure, especially in the richer countries, during the initial COVID crisis, and now there is a widespread effort to cut back government outlays. In the United States, extra benefits for the unemployed were terminated earlier this month, affecting 10 million people. In Australia, the big boost in unemployment benefits has ended. Vaccines are reducing the health impact of COVID without preventing widespread illness, disability from long COVID, and COVID-related deaths. They are being used as an excuse by many governments to roll back or eliminate public health measures that are costly or restrain economic activity. So, what's next? We don't know what is going to happen with the virus and vaccines, whether a new variant of SARS-CoV-2 virus will become more contagious and less, or probably more virulent. We don't know how existing vaccines will cope with future variants, which will inevitably emerge from the bodies of the millions of people still being infected. Nor do we know whether new, more effective vaccines will be developed. Harmful medical developments could seriously damage the world economy. But what about the better case scenarios of no major changes for the worse in the health impact of the virus? Well, there are dangers that may result from government responses to the COVID crisis. Governments, through their central banks, reduced interest rates to encourage growth, and governments also took on massive debts. An increase in interest rates could trigger widespread bankruptcy amongst companies whose marginal productivity was shored up by low rates of interest, and cheap borrowing. And higher interest rates would affect the many countries that are heavily indebted, even to their own central banks, when they have to roll over their bond issues. Chains of corporate bankruptcies could trigger a recession. That's an immediate concern in China, with Evergrande, the country's largest property developer, teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, and its bankruptcy would ripple through the property and financial sectors of the country. Government interest burdens will lead to attempts to cut back public spending even more. The social wage, spending on health, education, and welfare is an obvious target. That is, cuts that mainly harm workers. And overall decreases in government outlays would also slow economies and lead to unemployment. Then there's the question of inflation. There have been massive increases in the money supplies of most countries. Much of this has benefited the rich and gone into the inflation of asset prices, especially shares and real estate. Could it also be leading to price inflation? Certainly many prices are going up, but this is a consequence of a short-term mismatch between the boost in demand as economies come out of COVID downturns and production, which has been slower to recover. Well, maybe that's the case. Consumption can bounce back more rapidly than many production processes can be restarted or expanded. Trade in both inputs and finished products has been affected by uneven developments in different countries, and there were cutbacks in inventories and levels of production in anticipation of declines in demands for some commodities, declines which did not actually happen. Silicon chip inventories and production were reduced by the demand, but the demand for devices that included them actually rose. On the other hand, is inflation about to take off in a big way because of the expansion in money supplies? I doubt it, but economists are very divided. Overall, growth in China seems to be faltering while the US is still growing quite strongly, although it went into and came out of the COVID downturn later. Despite the plague, class struggles have continued. There have been large mobilizations against right-wing and authoritarian regimes in Chile, Burma, Myanmar, and Thailand. There have been recent strikes by retail workers and, with modest success, train drivers in Germany, and likewise Liverpool University workers in the UK fended off most of a round of sackings through strike action. There's still potential for us to end the capitalist world, and that with a cheer and not with a whimper. That's the end, comrade.
The end. I thought that was probably the end, but I just wanted to give you a couple of seconds to make sure.